This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Jessica Glenza of The Guardian.
And I'm OTM producer Alana Casanova Burgess. So instead of the equality arguments, we got Roe planted in, as Slate's Dahlia Lithwick described, the shakier and more conservative ground of a woman's private relationship with her doctor. So what are we facing now? She says there are two kinds of attacks on Roe. One is the use of trap laws, or targeted regulation of abortion providers. She thinks the conservatives on the court have a preference for chipping away at access, rather than an outright ban.
Presumably, by that theory, they will never write the sentence, Roe v. Wade is now overturned.
The second kind of attack, adopted this year, is much more direct.
What we're hearing in Alabama, what we're hearing in Georgia, you know, Texas had hearings about whether they could actually have capital punishment for women who have abortions. So there has been this new strain in passing these laws that are just purely punitive. This is not just about abortion anymore. Donald Trump has a nominee up for a federal judicial seat who is opposed to IVF, who is opposed to surrogacy.
Since we recorded this interview, that judge has been confirmed.
I think that we fail to apprehend that the attack on abortion loops in an attack on contraception, on Plan B, even sex education. It's incredibly myopic to think that this ends at six-week bans or heartbeat bans. I think this really does include, as I said, objections to even surrogacy. There's a little bit of NIMBYism sitting in New York and saying, well, it's never going to happen here because we'll always have access. But I think the long game is federal criminal penalties for women who terminate their pregnancies.
So fears about the end of Roe miss the bigger picture. Despite wide-ranging threats to women's reproductive freedom and legal rights, election after election, confirmation after confirmation, the conversation usually stops at Roe.
In the case that every nominee gets asked about, Roe v. Wade, can you tell me whether Roe was decided correctly?
Do you view Roe as having super precedent?
Senator McCain, you believe Roe v. Wade should be overturned. Senator Obama, you believe it shouldn't.
Do you believe that reasonable people can disagree on Roe v. Wade?
Do you think Roe v. Wade changed American society?
Roe is the settled law of the land. Do you mean settled for you?
Roe, by the way, is not the law.
That last voice was Duke Law Professor Neil Siegel, Justice Ginsburg's former law clerk. He's also served as a special counsel to senators during the Supreme Court confirmations, including those of Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch. Siegel says that actually, the law of the land was established not by Roe, but by Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992. That case upheld the right to abortion while allowing some restrictions. But it did stipulate that restrictions could not impose a, quote, undue burden for women. Today's court challenges are about that standard set by Casey.
I think it's important, not just pedantic, because Casey allows much more government regulation of abortion than Roe ever did.
Describe what you think a better question would be beyond, will you uphold Roe versus Wade?
Does the Constitution protect women too, and in what ways? Do restrictions on access to contraception implicate gender equality? How? Do restrictions on access to abortion, right? What about the treatment of pregnant workers in various circumstances? Because I think it would underscore that it's not simply a litmus test about views on abortion. It's about a much broader constitutional vision in which the parties today in a very polarized country really disagree. I mean, why does opposition to abortion among certain religious groups highly correlated with opposition to same-sex marriage? Whatever you think about same-sex marriage, it has nothing to do with destroying fetuses. So why is it that you have similarly strong opposition? I think it has a lot to do with views about the traditional family and people occupying non-traditional gender roles.
There's a term, reproductive justice, which expands the frame beyond Roe and beyond abortion.
So the elevator speech is the right to have a child, not to have a child, and to raise and parent your children in safe and healthy ways. Implicit in that right is the human right to bodily autonomy, gender identity, the right to control, and defines one's sex and sexuality.
Loretta Ross is a visiting professor at Smith College, and she's one of 12 African-American women who in 1994 were eager to broaden how these issues were discussed in the U.S.
We spliced together the concept of reproductive rights and social justice and created the term reproductive justice.
In the U.S. abortion argument, relatively little time seemed to be devoted to the lack of options leading up to pregnancy, access to contraception, say, or sex education. And even less attention was paid to the challenges women face after choosing to have a child, including limited or no access to maternal health care or child care. And in all this, the U.S. lagged behind the international conversation.
Well, we came up with the framework 3 months before the September 1994 International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo. But when we went to Cairo, what we found that what we were demanding under the U.S. constitutional system was something that the world feminist community was demanding under the human rights framework, that no individual can successfully manage their own fertility in a context in which they're experiencing systemic and sustained underdevelopment. In other words, you can't self-help yourself out of a situation where there's no healthcare system.
So it sounds like you had two realizations during that time. One, that maybe choice was too narrow. And the second, that you were not asking for as much as your global colleagues.
Well, that's true. When people talked about human rights in the United States, they basically imagined a tortured prisoner in a jail overseas somewhere. They weren't necessarily seeing the human rights violations that are committed in the United States by either the government, the state, or corporations or individuals when people are denied full access to their reproductive decision making. And so we felt it was very vital to bring human rights home and not be limited to the narrow interpretations and the legalistic limits of the U.S. Constitution.
Ross is also a founder of the sister song Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, and she's served as an escort to women and girls who don't have access to abortion where they live and need to travel to other states for the procedure. A 2017 study found that nearly 90% of U.S. counties, accounting for almost 40% of women of reproductive age, had no abortion clinics whatsoever. And yet, geography isn't the only barrier. She says that imagining Roe as a sacred rampart that guarantees access to abortion has been wrong since pretty much the beginning.
Well, we've always been in a post-Roe world for people who lack access to basic health care. And of course, with the passing of the 1976 Hyde Amendment that set up reproductive health care access, depending on whether or not your health care is provided by the federal government, which prohibits, of course, poor women on Medicaid and the Indian Health Services and in the military from accessing the same reproductive health care, particularly abortion care, that people who don't have their health care provided by the federal government. Since the 70s, we've had a two-tiered healthcare system that is packed with discrimination based on status and class.
So should we stop talking about Roe versus Wade then?
Well, you don't pull your finger out the dike while you're building a better dam. I mean, no. We still have to talk about it, but we have to also recognize that its porousness is what allows people to chip away with it.
I've never thought that the abortion issue was a standalone issue.
Yale Law School professor Reva Siegel is co-editor of the book Reproductive Rights and Justice Stories. She's got another phrase to denote the broader issue of women's reproductive rights and freedoms. She calls it pro-choice life.
The pro-choice life framework is asking us to evaluate the stakes. If a state claims to restrict abortion because it cares about unborn life, but it doesn't help a woman who wants to avoid motherhood do so through providing sex ed or contraception, or it doesn't help a woman who wants to become a mother by providing her health care or work family accommodations, how genuinely or systematically does it really care about protecting life? Like, what are we to make of the underlying value choices there? Are they judgments about women, or are they really commitments to the unborn?
Take, for example, the state involved in the latest Supreme Court case.
The Attorney General of Louisiana said today, "We will not waver in defense of our state's pro-woman and pro-life laws, and we will continue to do all we legally can to protect Louisiana women."
So it's restricting access to abortion, but it has one of the highest maternal mortality rates with respect to childbearing in the United States. With respect to race, the numbers are even worse. Similarly, the state of Louisiana hasn't done Medicaid expansion for pregnant women that other states have. So there's a point to asking jurisdictions that claim to be pro-life outside the abortion context, how do their policy choices compare with other jurisdictions? There actually are commitments of care that may prove to be purple issues through which we can do coalition politics, even if we can't agree around the abortion issue.
So in other words, it's a way to look at the problem, but also a way to find common ground that we may think of as non-existent.
100%. For an example, when I was in law school, I worked on issues of employment accommodation for pregnant women. It's ridiculous, but we're still having difficulty with that question. You would think that a country as torn up as we are around issues of abortion would at least manage to get it right with respect to the employment of women when they're pregnant. But it turns out that that's one of the highest issues of employment discrimination that we have. Right now in Congress, there was finally a hearing for a Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, which would require the reasonable accommodation of pregnant employees. And to this point, the Republican Party has not quite managed to get in line in support of the legislation. The question is, why not? Why wouldn't the Party of Life commit along those lines? Having said this, I think 27 states have passed these laws at the state level, and many are red and purple. South Carolina has passed the law, Kentucky has passed the law, Utah has passed the law. So these are laws that jurisdictions that consider themselves pro-life can get behind. There are grounds where people can come together, and I think it would be a great thing if we found more of those.
There used to be more common ground. Reva Siegel is also the author, with Linda Greenhouse, of Before Roe v. Wade, Voices That Shaped the Abortion Debate Before the Supreme Court's Ruling. They document a counterintuitive history. For instance, more Republicans than Democrats supported legalizing abortion, and a vast web of religious leaders known as the Clergy Consultation Service helped women get access to the procedure.
This was a network that ran across state lines all over the United States. These acts of conscience were to ensure that women who were going to have access to abortion would do so in a way that would allow them to act with dignity, to preserve their fertility, to preserve their lives. The usage of conscience was reversed to the way that we understand claims on conscience asserted today. There, the law breaking was to provide access to abortion, and the claims there were for life, that is to say, to protect women's lives.
But feminists originally didn't understand abortion to be, quote, part of their central narrative, as Siegel and Greenhouse put it, at least not until the women's strike for equality in 1970.
Betty Friedan, this seems like one of the most exciting weeks the women's liberation movement has ever known. Well, how do you feel?
It's much more than that. It's perhaps the most exciting week in the history of women.
It was a kind of spontaneous action that took place around the United States. 50,000 people marched in New York. In other cities, they were smaller.
We are urging women not to take care of children on this one day. And this will mean there will be offices all over the country that will be flooded with children brought to their fathers, and let them worry about this problem.
They were marking the anniversary of women's right to vote. August 26th of 1970 was the half century anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment.
Women all over the country are calling and writing and saying they aren't going to cook that day. And to many women, this is the only thing they're going to do. They're not going to get out in the street. But for one day, you know, after 6,000 years, they're not going to cook. And I think this is very significant.
And these demands were saying something to the tune of, women will have equal citizenship, not only when they can vote, but also when they have the ability to transform the conditions under which they conceive and bear children.
Another thing we're doing is we're passing out contraceptive information in the streets of various cities.
They were making claims for a set of new demands, including ratification of an equal rights amendment, still not ratified, and equal employment and educational opportunity. That was the passage of, among other things, Title IX, which would get passed out of that. Second demand was access to abortion rights. And the third was for access to 24-hour childcare. People don't know it, but there was nearly passed a federal childcare statute in the wake of that strike. And so you can see that the claim for abortion rights is appearing as nested in these equality rights of the women's movement circa 1970.
And in New York and Connecticut, lawyers had already begun bringing suits using the equality language just a few years before Ginsburg wrote her Supreme Court brief in the Susan Strzok case.
The complaint in the New York case said that abortion laws are both the result and the symbol of the unequal treatment of women, and so long as such a, quote, broad range of disabilities are permitted to attach to the status of pregnancy and motherhood, that status must be one of choice. So these arguments were definitely circulating, but they weren't articulated by the United States Supreme Court when it actually decided Roe.
And so what should we expect from today's conservative bench without the swing vote of Justice Kennedy? Reva Siegel said she had a revelation recently when she was walking across Yale's campus. She was going to teach a class about Kennedy's decisions for the first time since his retirement and since Kavanaugh's appointment.
So the normal response to anybody who's concerned about this body of law is one generally of dread, if not horror. But I had suddenly this sense of, I was really flooded with this sense of relief. And in fact, the light was probably not coming from the sky, but from me. And it was just this sense that there was no longer a chance of making any sense of this law in a way that would satisfy or persuade anyone in the United States Supreme Court. And the fact that it was no longer possible, and therefore one was free to talk about what the Constitution means and requires, free of their control, because one couldn't persuade them.
In the same way that a wildfire can be incredibly destructive, you suddenly have all this new room for growth potential that you see in this body of law that you care about so much.
Absolutely. And because I want to bring us all the way back to that story that I told you about the strike for equality and the 19th Amendment. What was that story but a story about women who had never been adequately or fully or fairly represented in the American constitutional order, trying to make their voices heard at a point at which they were still facing a judiciary in which women were only 1% of the sitting justices or judges, virtually no women in the United States Congress. And yet they did succeed in making themselves heard, but their voices were garbled. So if this story, which has been part and parcel of the American constitutional tradition, coming on a half century now, gets retold, it will get retold in more robust and better grounded terms by decision makers who better represent the American polity. This court is deciding questions that are deeply at odds with the understandings and mores of a lot of young people. My view is that this body of law is going to evolve and change and regrow through mobilizations across state lines and through state legislatures and in state courts and over new generations, and maybe grow in a new and a better way. But it's going to take some time for that to happen. And what will emerge from it will be a better and a stronger thing. That's at least the most positive thing I can say about it.
Reva Siegel is a professor of law at Yale and co-editor, most recently, of Reproductive Rights and Justice Stories.
That's it for this week's show, which was produced and reported by Alana Casanova Burgess and Guardian journalist Jessica Glenza. Special thanks to WNYC archivist Andy Lancet. On the Media is also produced by Micah Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Astha Chaturvedi. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show is edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Josh Hahn was our engineer. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
One last thing before we go. The Guardian wants to hear from women who served in the military before 1976 about their experience with the policy against motherhood. Go to gu.com/militarymotherhood. That's gu.com/militarymotherhood. And thanks.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.